From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, guerrilla films on the fall of communism in Poland. With the authorization of Solidarity, filmmaker Piotr Bikant got inside Solidarity strikes. Now Bikant's just completed a series of films for the BBC on Poland's first year of democracy. Also today, a talk with the actor who led 8,000 extras across the Red Sea, painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and was whipped by an army of apes, Charlton Heston. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says these days more and more good jazz is coming out of Scandinavia, and Kevin has one new example. And after going into hibernation for a few months, the series Northern Exposure is back on TV. David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The UN Security Council's president has recommended an official ceasefire to the Persian Gulf War. Belgian Ambassador Paul Notre-Dame, the current president of the Security Council, drafted a letter to Iraq today, noting the body's reception of a letter from Iraq accepting the ceasefire terms. Several ambassadors are apparently consulting with their countries overnight, and a council decision on accepting a formal ceasefire will probably happen tomorrow morning. British Prime Minister John Major has proposed establishing a UN-occupied zone in northern Iraq to protect the Kurdish refugees. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Luxembourg.
Prime Minister Major's proposal came during a summit of the leaders of the 12 members of the European Community in Luxembourg. In a speech to the 12, Major called Saddam Hussein murderous and abhorrent and said the UN should create an enclave in northern Iraq to protect the people of Iraqi Kurdistan and permit them to return to their homes. Major was not specific about how large such an enclave should be, nor did he spell out how the UN could gain control of that territory. But British officials are speaking of a large area of northern Iraq to include the principal Kurdish cities there. British officials say the basis for such action has been laid in the Security Council resolutions adopted last week. The British are vague when asked how such an enclave could be established if the government in Baghdad does not agree to it. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl is said to be supporting the British plan. Prime Minister Major also said he did not believe sanctions against Iraq should be lifted until Saddam Hussein is removed from power. I'm Mike Schuster in Luxembourg.
The French publishing giant Hachette says that it's freezing the shares of its stock, which is owned by an investment company allegedly controlled by Iraq. Last month, a New York investigator said Baghdad had bought shares in Hachette and other companies in order to divert oil revenues and support its military arsenals. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Hachette said it's freezing 8.4% of its shares, which are owned by Montana Investment, in order to abide by the UN Security Council sanctions against Iraq. Last month, U.S. investigator Jules Kroll said Montana was a front company for Baghdad. In a communique today, Hachette said Montana maintains it's owned by a number of investors in the Gulf. However, Hachette said it's uncovered information during the past few days, which prompted its decision to freeze the stock. It didn't specify what it had discovered. Hachette said it's prepared to buy out Montana in the future if necessary. Hachette was one of the few companies which was singled out by Kroll. Its majority shareholder also owns one of France's largest arms manufacturers. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 29 points to close at 29.18.56. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading of 139 million shares. This is NPR. Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates has won a temporary restraining order, which will permit him to return to work until a hearing is held later this month, looking at his involuntary 60-day suspension by the L.A. Police Commission. Gates was put on paid leave last week, pending an investigation of the videotaped beating of motorist Rodney King by several officers. Although the leave was not intended to be punitive, Gates has argued that the panel acted without proper authority because he has not been charged with any specific misconduct. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has released the annual report on the overall health status of Americans today. NPR's Caroline Clark has more from Washington.
The report showed the nation's infant mortality rate in 1990 stood at a record low of 9.1 infant deaths per 1,000 live births. Secretary Louis Sullivan says increased access to prenatal care contributed to this biggest single-year drop in infant mortality.
It may also be related to our public and private programs to decrease illegal drug use, alcohol abuse, or use of tobacco by pregnant women.
The racial breakdown isn't available yet for the 1990 infant mortality figures, but in 1988, the black rate was more than double the white rate. Racial and ethnic differences could also be found in life expectancy figures, with AIDS and rising homicide rates leading to the seventh consecutive year of declining black life expectancy. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
This is opening day for the 1991 Major League Baseball season. In the American League, the Kansas City Royals beat the Cleveland Indians 4-2, the Chicago White Sox blew out Baltimore 9-1, and the Boston Red Sox defeated the Toronto Blue Jays 6-2. In the National League, the New York Mets defeated the Philadelphia Phillies 2-1, and the Cincinnati Reds defeated the Houston Astros 6-2. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've all read about the collapse of communism and the beginnings of democracy in Poland. My guest, Piotr Bikant, has captured it on video and film. With the authorization of Solidarity, he made an underground trilogy that got inside the 1988 Solidarity strikes in the Gdansk shipyard and the 1989 Warsaw Roundtable negotiations between the communist regime and the Solidarity leaders. He just completed a series of films for the BBC on Poland's first year of democracy. Throughout most of the 80s, Bikant wrote for Solidarity's Underground Weekly. He's been a part of Poland's artistic as well as political life. He's translated such poets as Allen Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Charles Bukowski into Polish. He worked at Jerzy Grotowski's Actors Institute and has performed with avant-garde rock and jazz bands. Bikant made his Solidarity films at a time when the Polish people were suspicious of cameras.
I started my Solidarity independent underground conspiracy films in 1988 during the May strike in the shipyard. And it was a turning point, as we see it now, in the history of the downfall of communism. But at the same time, I see it as from my own personal experience, as a turn point in people's relation, attitude towards the media. Usually, up till that time, people were very reluctant about the presence of cameras or microphones, especially in the situations where it was a protest, a demonstration, a strike, because it would usually be police cameras or cameras of those who might be used by police. Me and my colleague jumped right in the middle of the strike into the shipyard and were immediately accepted by the strikers as a part of the strike. So the camera itself played a role of, you might say, a striker from the artistic point of view, or a striker's weapon. That is, they would want me to film policemen or secret agents, not even to have their faces recorded, but simply to use the weapon against them. And it was striking that the police, when you put the camera, aimed the camera at them from behind the striking shipyard gate, would turn away their faces, would retreat, It was a totally new experience.
Did you try to use the camera to prevent police from harassing strikers? In other words, if you saw that happening, would you go there with your camera in the hopes that it would stop?
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. An anecdote is that one night, because the shipyard during the May strike was surrounded by police, the people were not allowed to come close. And the strikers were all the time under the pressure of the possibility that the police or the army would come in, march in, and beat everybody and end the strike. So they would, especially, this atmosphere was especially high during nights. So they would come to me and say, come to the gate with your camera, or they would announce through the loudspeaker, cameras to the gate, cameras to the gate. I would say, but it's pitch dark, the camera doesn't see anything really, I cannot record anything in darkness. And they would say, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, just come, because maybe when they see your camera, then they will be afraid.
Now, once your camera was confiscated by the police, but they didn't realize the camera was still on, so it actually, the camera recorded its own confiscation. The camera recorded its own arrest. What did they confiscate the camera for? What were the circumstances?
The shipyard was guarded by the strikers, but at the same time, it was guarded by the Internal Security Service, which was with the management. At some moment, these guards, security service, attacked my colleague who was carrying the camera and stole it away from him. But they never turned it off. They called the manager, and the manager told them to... They told the manager they can't keep the camera because the strikers want it back and they can attack their little hut. So the manager told them to, and we hear it all because it's all recorded by the camera, which is lying on the table. We don't see it, but we hear it. And the camera is then taken to the manager in such a way that it's wrapped up in paper, and we actually see the process of the camera being wrapped up and transported in conspiracy by a car to the manager.
Well, you must have been really surprised to find out that the camera had been left on and actually recorded what was happening.
We were very much surprised. We found it only a week or two later because all our materials were had to be, the footage had to be smuggled out gradually from the shipyard. We never knew how the strike would end, and the highest chance was that the police would burst in, or maybe even the army, and beat everybody up, take the equipment, take the footage, and so we had to smuggle it gradually out, which was not very easy. It was smuggled by little school kids who would come back and forth cheating police. So the footage was out, and after we were out of the strike, we started editing the film, and at some moment we came up on a cassette which we didn't know what's on, really. We couldn't figure out what it is, but, you know, after listening to it for a while, we found that it's simply the camera working all by itself.
And you decided to leave that part in the movie.
Yes, yes. Some of my colleagues said immediately, oh, let's throw it out, let's re-record it, it's nothing. And I said, well, are you crazy? This is the best part of the film. Or we can make it a separate film by itself. So we put it into the film. I think this shows, this is like another side to this problem of media versus people involved in political situations.
What do you mean?
I mean that as we spoke about how the workers, how the strikers suddenly changed their attitude towards the media and accepted it as theirs. The other side didn't have enough knowledge of the media to use it in any way, or to, for example, stop to stop it from being used by itself against them.
You wrote for an underground weekly throughout most of the 1980s. I assume there's no longer an underground in the press anymore?
Practically no. Especially the underground as we understood it in Poland, which meant conspiracy and illegal situation, conspiracy, something you could be punished for. This does not exist anymore, practically. I worked for an underground weekly, Tygodnik Mazowsze, during the martial law, and these people came out from under the ground and formed now a daily, which was the first independent daily in post-communist states.
This is the daily that you did your recent movie about?
Yes, This is done by the same people that I either know for years or have been watching since mid-70s sometimes. And it's very interesting to, for me at least, to see how they find themselves in this new situation, how they manage to produce a number one daily press in Poland, which is very powerful, which has the power to shape the opinion, which really is the fourth pillar of the of power somehow, and at the same time remain truthful to their ideals of independence and of friendship and of brotherhood, let's say, even. And at the same time, they have to do it in a very difficult conditions, in a place that's unbelievably unsuitable for anything like editing a newspaper.
What are some of the editorial problems faced now by journalists who used to be working at an underground paper and are now working at the first free paper in independent Eastern Europe?
Well, the main problem is the problem of independence. This is something that has to be redefined sometimes day after day. Because during the underground time, it was very often independence was understood as being actively against communism, or sometimes passively even. But in the situation we are facing now, of course, it's much more complicated because a lot of questions arise, like can a journalist be a party member of any party right now or not? A journalist, of course, wants to influence a good journalist at least wants to influence the world he's in, and the question is by what means? By becoming an ally of some party or not? By shaping information, to what extent? This is a new experience, and it's very interesting. I mean, I believe it's quite obvious to people who are used to live in more stable democracies, like, I don't know, the United States democracy, which is of course a system which could be defined, where more or less, where Polish political system is absolutely undefined. We are going into capitalism, and we don't know how to do it really. It usually takes sometimes hundreds of years to shape the system, whereas we have to do it in a couple of years only. So we don't even know. We have the same tools to use, but we have no time.
My guest is Polish documentary filmmaker Piotr Bikont. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Polish filmmaker Piotr Bikont is my guest. He's made documentaries about Solidarity, the fall of communism, and the first year of democracy in Poland. Back in the days of martial law, you were imprisoned. You were imprisoned from December of 81 to October of 82. What were you put in jail for?
This was internment, so there was no sentence, really. But I was interned, the paper said, which I got when I was let out, not when I was put in. The letter said that I'm interred because there are certain possibilities that I might undertake activities which could bring harm to the state.
That's pretty vague.
that's pretty vague. But it meant that I was quite strongly involved in Solidarity and before that, I was involved in the so-called democratic opposition in Poland, underground press, underground magazines, underground concerts, underground presentations, actions, leaflets. And then I was part of students' revolt in 81, which was parallel to Solidarity.
What was the student revolt like?
Well, it was... we were trying to legalize our union, just as Solidarity. We would even like to call ourselves Solidarity, but this was, for some reasons, quite impossible because Solidarity didn't want the union. So we created an independent students' association. I was one of the leaders, and we were trying to get legal, and we were trying to win autonomy for our universities, which meant that the universities would be exterritorial, that they could choose their own deans and rectors, and so on. The students and the professors also would have influence on what the program is, and so on.
During the year that you were in internment, what did you do? Were you alone in a cell? Were there other people with you?
That situation changed. It was 10 months of being... taken from one place to another, from one prison to another, from one cell to another. But most often we would have like 14 people in a very small space. A regular Polish prison, but you don't know what I mean, of course.
That's right.
A pretty bad prison. But gradually, throughout these 10 months, the situation would be more... the prison regime would be smaller and smaller, and even at one moment I began making a film. Somebody smuggled me in a roll of 35mm celluloid blank, translucent transparent blank, and I tried to draw on this blank. I made myself in prison, a little animation table, and I for hours and hours I was making my little film there. Unfortunately, at some moment the conditions became worse, and the prison security guards burst in, beaten us up, and took everything away, including my little film, which I never saw and never will see.
Did you talk about politics a lot in prison?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Because we were, most of us in the cell were there because of, as they say, because of Solidarity. So, of course, we would talk about what's happened, about the past times, and also about the future times, what will happen later. And I remember we were very pessimistic. Especially pessimistic when we talk that one day we will win, the communism will be over, and that will be really the tough time, and that would be the time really to emigrate, because then everybody would be fighting with each other, and we will be treated like old combatants. Is that the right word?
Yes.
Word?
Yeah. So was it prophetic?
Well, to a big extent.
Are you thinking of getting out?
No. I'm not. But of course not. But the situation is not encouraging, I would say. Especially, you know, the beautiful ethos of this opposition of 70s especially, and then of the 80s and of Solidarity is gone. Solidarity doesn't exist anymore as an ethos, as an idea. There's no solidarity between people. It's very sad. It's like a lost chance, perhaps, but on the other hand, a chance that had to be lost.
My guest has been Polish documentary filmmaker Piotr Bikant. Okay, time for a pop quiz. Our quizmaster is TV critic David Bianculli. Watch out, though, for some trick questions.
Let's do a little word association test. I'll say some phrases, and you say what TV show they remind you of. And remember, as Pee-wee Herman says, to scream real loud. Otherwise, I won't be able to hear you. Ready? Here we go. Majestic Douglas Firs, a very small town in the far northwest. Quirky people who are filled with secrets. Fantasy sequences. Beautiful, mysterious women. Strange signals from outer space. And finally, unusual animals and spirits in the woods. Based on most of the screams out there, and some of you are just screaming, period, I figure most of you think I'm going to spend another report talking about Twin Peaks. Logical answer, but meh, all those things I just mentioned are also part of the mix on Northern Exposure, a wonderfully weird CBS series that begins its second season tonight. Northern Exposure received its first exposure last summer when CBS tried showing relatively low-budget original series instead of wall-to-wall reruns. Out of that experiment, only two survived. Top Cops made the schedule immediately, and Northern Exposure was given a bigger budget and an order to make new episodes. The star of Northern Exposure is Rob Morrow. He plays Joel Fleischman, a young doctor from New York who gets a scholarship by promising to practice in a hospital in Fairbanks, Alaska. But that hospital didn't need him, so they sent him out to the tiny Alaskan town of Sicily. Joel spent most of last season complaining and being homesick, and things haven't changed much. Now that winter has arrived in Sicily, Joel's conversations with airline pilot Maggie, played by Janine Turner, are even colder than before.
It's just what I dreamed of when I was at Columbia. I was actually practicing medicine in a room where I can't feel my fingers.
It's not that cold.
It's 40 degrees inside if you don't count the wind chill factor blowing through these cracks.
If you take off your snowsuit, you'd get acclimated.
My blood would thicken? Oh, that's very scientific. Like with a car, colder climate, more viscous motor oil. Well, I have nice, thin New York blood. You probably don't have blood at all.
Get off my case, Fleischman. Just give me my pills.
No problem.
Joel and Maggie have the funniest, sexiest love-hate relationship since David and Maddie on Moonlighting. But they're not the only reasons to watch Northern Exposure. The town is full of neat characters, and the show is full of talented actors, including Darren E. Burroughs as the laid-back Ed, who's kind of a Reverend Jim without drugs, and Barry Corbin and John Cullum as the town's father figures. In tonight's season opener, Cullum, who plays the owner of the local tavern, buys a satellite TV dish, which is where those strange signals from outer space come in.
Just look at that. Here we are in Sicily, Alaska, clean across the great Pacific Ocean, watching an Italian documentary on Chinese food shoppers in action.
I had a cat like that when I was a kid, Little Edgar.
I don't believe those are pets, Ed.
No?
I believe they're tomorrow night's dinner.
Hey, Ed, we eat a lot of things other cultures consider disgusting. Moose, caribou, bear, seal.
I wonder how they kick up those fur balls.
Next week's show is all about two unusual visitors to Sicily, an Indian ghost who helps Ed search for his long-lost parents, and a gorgeous woman whose beauty somehow strips the town DJ of his ability to speak. Like everything else about Northern Exposure, it's handled just right, and it's a lot of fun to watch. Oh, about the unusual animal I mentioned as part of the quiz? Watch for it in the opening credits, walking down the main street of town. It's a moose. Which, I guess, makes Northern Exposure a moose-see show.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, The Voice of God and Moses and Michelangelo. We talk with veteran actor Charlton Heston. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some thoughts on the relationship between music and climate. He reviews the new album from Finnish drummer Edward Vesala. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker is now in Israel in the second part of his latest peace mission to the Middle East. From Israel, Baker goes on to Egypt and Syria during his second trip to that area in the last month. Patricia Golan reports that shortly before Baker's arrival, Israel decided to free some Palestinian detainees as a gesture of goodwill.
Although the Israeli Defense Ministry insists the release is not connected with Secretary Baker's visit, it nevertheless fits into what Baker terms confidence-building measures he's seeking in the Middle East. Israel holds about 14,000 Palestinians in connection with the 39-month-old Palestinian uprising against Israeli rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, many of them held in administrative detention without trial. There were earlier reports that the authorities intended to reopen four Palestinian universities in the near future, which were closed because authorities considered them hotbeds of unrest. The Defense Ministry announcement said that more than 1,000 prisoners would be freed on the occasion of the Muslim feast of Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. The Defense Ministry also promised to encourage economic development in the impoverished Gaza Strip. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Democratic reforms will apparently come slowly to Kuwait, despite an announcement by Kuwait's ruler, which promised parliamentary elections next year. A Kuwaiti official today made it clear that new elections will still be tightly restricted. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Kuwait City.
In his first speech to his liberated country, the emir of Kuwait held out hope for democratic reform in a nation where just 10% of the citizens are allowed to vote. Kuwait has not had an elected parliament for 5 years. That's when the ruler, Sheikh Jaber al-Sabah, suspended the country's constitution. Pressure for reform has been mounting from Kuwaiti opposition groups, and yesterday the emir promised elections and said he would consider extending voting rights to all citizens. But today the acting minister for cabinet affairs explained that elections will not occur until late in 1992, and even then political parties will not be allowed. The minister said women may be allowed to vote in the elections, but so-called second-class citizens, naturalized Kuwaitis, must wait for a new parliament to consider their voting rights. The official said freedom of the press will also be considered after the elections. This is Michael Scholar in Kuwait City.
According to Tehran Radio, more than 750,000 Iraqi refugees have crossed the border into Iran. According to these Iranian accounts, insurgents in northern and southern Iraq have resumed their attacks on government forces. The State Department has confirmed only that opposition to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's government is continuing. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 22 points to close at 2,918.56 in light trading. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, Police Chief Daryl Gates has won a temporary restraining order allowing him to go back to work. This order came hours after a coalition of civil rights groups filed suit, charging that Gates and the city council colluded to get him back on the job, despite a paid leave ordered by the police commission. This comes in the wake of a videotaped beating of a black motorist last month by several L.A. police officers. In South Africa, Manasuta Buthelezi has warned Nelson Mandela's African National Congress that its actions could provoke a civil war. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Last Friday, Nelson Mandela's ANC issued an ultimatum to the government. There were seven demands relating to the ending of township violence. They included removing all weapons from people attending political rallies and that the ministers of defense and law and order be fired. Today, the leader of the other political group involved in the township conflicts, Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi of the Inkatha Freedom Party, reacted to the ultimatum. Buthelezi said these demands would precipitate nothing less than a civil war, because the ruling National Party would break up if it gave in to them. Buthelezi said that President F.W. de Klerk must bear down on the ANC and rip out of it the cancer of its lust for power. He said it might become necessary to continue negotiations for a new constitution without the ANC. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
According to the official Iraqi news service, Baghdad has denounced Allied airdrops of supplies to Kurdish refugees as a violation of its internal affairs. According to this report, the Iraqi foreign minister has sent a letter to the UN Secretary General protesting that the operation proves what he called the evil intentions harbored by the U.S. and Britain toward Iraq. The letter said if the donors were sincere, they would have sent the aid directly to Iraq or by way of Jordan and Turkey. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Holy mountain, to behold your glory and receive your law, what have I left undone?
That's Charlton Heston as Moses. Heston's booming voice reverberated in other biblical epics like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. He not only was close to God in his movies, he played the genius Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy. He was a cop in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, a lonely cowboy in Will Penny. He was the pursued in The Planet of the Apes and was subjected to earthquakes and airplane catastrophes in the disaster films of the 70s. I wanted to know what it was like to shoot the scene in the Ten Commandments in which he led the exodus of Jews out of Egypt.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took, to get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because to get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur or any of those films again, because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today, it would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you notice what a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But this, obviously, those scenes are... In a sense, the English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. You are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even though it's all stage, you've still got, 8,000 people following
yes,
you.
Yes, yes. It's quite an awesome experience.
You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is telling the Ten Commandments.
Which I think is perfectly logical, because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Category for chariot races, though.
Right. So you had to...
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it was not... It didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture... I was a minimally competent charioteer, but as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, "You know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here, And when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not. And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Well, Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks of work in the chariot, but he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There was all these scenes where...
action sequence, mm-hmm. if the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And they didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident... was I drove a great deal of the sequences, mm-hmm. but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out with and I didn't do that. Joe Canott, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him because those things weighed 1/2 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, we got to use that shot. And Jack said, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot? And Willie said, well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in, which I did very quickly.
Did that look convincing to you when it was cut together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's totally convincing. It was not my favorite shot to do, I'll tell you, but it's totally convincing.
You had to climb back in as the chariot was moving.
Yes, but I was on the tongue of the chariot between the horses and the chariot itself.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your movie career. And my guest is Charlton Heston. This is Fresh Air. Charlton Heston is my guest. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me in the epic movies that you made, one of the things you had to do was show a lot of bare chest.
Depends. I'm in certainly The Slave Galley in Ben-Hur. In Commandments in the Brickyards. Nothing in El Cid. I guess I was naked in Planet of the Apes for a couple of scenes. A certain amount of skin, no question. That's not unheard of these days either.
No.
What'd you say?
Absolutely. Have you been made some really ludicrous offers by people who wanted you to be at their event in some kind of quasi-biblical get-up or persona?
I think word has gotten around that's
that you don't do that. Yeah,
do. I wouldn't say that's a major problem.
Right.
It's come up once or twice, maybe, but.
In 1969, you made the movie Planet of the Apes, which turned out to be a huge commercial success, one of the biggest movies of the year at the box office. What was your opinion of the script when you first looked at it and of the final film?
I was impressed by the script. I was a little surprised at the extraordinary success of the film because it took 2 years to get anyone to finance it. See, this was, I suppose, Planet of the Apes was the first of the space operas in which we are still awash. You know, Star Trek and Star Wars and so on, Return of the Jedi, are all space operas. And at the time, the studio said, you guys are crazy. You want to do a film with spaceships and talking monkeys? This is like Buck Rogers, Saturday morning serials. And that's how they viewed the genre, which had not been touched since the Saturday morning serials of the 30s. And, of course, we had struck a nerve with audiences, as filmmakers are still discovering.
I figure all the actors in the movie really envied you because you didn't have to wear the ape makeup.
Indeed, they did.
On the other hand, you had to take a lot
of
physical abuse in the film.
I didn't get to wear any clothes in a couple of scenes either.
Well, you also had to take a lot of physical abuse.
It certainly was true. I didn't realize it until we were halfway through the picture, but in almost every scene, I either get hit or chased or whipped or netted or sprayed with fire hoses, and it was a strenuous undertaking. But it's a good film, and I'm very glad I made it.
Yeah, all
especially since, in effect, it started a whole genre.
Mm-hmm. Is it exhausting to go through a day where you take that much abuse?
Well, making a film is exhausting.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, making a film, acting in a film, especially directing a film, is not fun. It's not supposed to be fun. A movie's supposed to be marvelous to watch, exciting, amusing, frightening, whatever, inspiring, whatever it's supposed to be. But making it, it's not supposed to be fun for the people who make it. On the other hand, as Orson Welles said memorably, making a movie is the best set of electric trains any little boy ever had to play with. And both those statements are true, and if you can't understand them, I can't explain it.
In the 70s, you starred in several of the disaster films, including Earthquake, which was one of the first. How did you end up being in, what was it, four?
We were all in disaster films. The reason for that is very clear. Disaster films are, in essence, multiple Jeopardy stories. You take a natural disaster or a man-made disaster or a threatening circumstance and put a cast of disparate characters, a dozen or 15 people who don't know each other, most of them. And the point of the story is how they respond to the circumstances. And it's a perfectly valid genre. But if you're making a movie about it, you have these 12 or 15 people, and you introduce each one in a scene in the beginning. And they're usually not in the same scene because they don't know each other. They're not supposed to. That's part of the idea. Then you'd often don't see them again for half an hour. And if they come up again, you don't want the audience saying, let's see, who was that? Was that that fire chief in the beginning? And the guy said, then they want to say, no, that was Steve McQueen, dummy. This is Paul Newman. He plays the architect. And for that, you need very high profile, very well-known actors. And we all did at least two of them. And finally, they used up all the possible stories, and the audience got tired of them. And I think we were all tired of them, too, by then. But we made an awful lot of money out of them.
In Earthquake, you actually asked for your character to be killed at the end.
Well, I thought, I said, I didn't ask. I had script approval.
Oh, you did?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
And I said, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. I play this nice architect who knows there's going to be an earthquake, and they got to build the buildings differently, and he has this terrible wife and this nice mistress. And at the end of the picture, the earthquake proves that he's right about the buildings, and it kills his mean wife, and he gets to go on into a happy future designing earthquake-proof buildings with this beautiful Canadian girl, Geneviève Bujold. And I said, let's surprise him a little. Let's have him killed, too. And so they did.
Did you have to work hard to convince them?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Charlton Heston is my guest. You served a very long term as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
7 years, yeah. Longer than anyone.
I'm wondering if you feel that affected your acting career at all. And if you felt that
No.
I wonder also if you feel that Hollywood has ever divided politically, like the kind of director who might hire your liberal counterpart, Ed Asner, or the kind of director who would hire you. Do you know what I mean? In other words, if Hollywood in its casting ever splits along political lines, conservative and liberal.
I'm sure Ed hopes so, too. Although Ed is implied sometimes that that is the case. I've never felt that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was president of the Guild, and up until that time, not only the officers, but most of the board members were very well-known actors. That is not true now, and I have no idea why that's true, except I suppose there are so many people in the Guild. There are now some 82,000 members of the Guild, which is a horrifying figure. But I've certainly never felt that not only my leadership of the Guild, but my political opinions in general have affected my employability. I still seem to be making a good living.
Did you ever see the movie My Dinner with Andre?
Yes. Yes, I know. I'm referred to favorably in that. And I'm, it's the first, I guess that's the first time that's ever happened to me.
So when did you find out about it in the theater when you were watching the movie, or did you know by the time you saw the movie that your autobiography
was mentioned? I can't
remember,
frankly. I know two or three critics mentioned that, but I can't remember whether I read those comments before or after I'd seen the film. But I liked the film. I thought it was quite interesting.
And that must have been good for business, too.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think. I was not billed.
That's actor Charlton Heston. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what's the latest that you have on the Kurdish refugees?
Well, there's an appeal from Britain now to actually create a Kurdish enclave in northern Iraq. We don't know exactly how large such an enclave would be, but we'll hear about that from NPR's Mike Schuster. Also, a talk with a Turkish journalist in Washington about what the Turks regard as a fairly bitter experience they had after they let about 60,000 Kurdish refugees into the east of their country back in 1988. No sooner had they done that, it seems, than they were criticized by European countries for not providing adequate treatment for the people whom they gave refuge to.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's surprised by how many good big bands come from Scandinavia these days, like Denmark's Afropop-flavored New Jungle Orchestra and Norway's freewheeling Circulazione Totale Orchestra. Kevin has a review of a new album by Finnish bandleader and drummer Edvard Vesala. Listening to all this music has Kevin thinking about environmental determinism in jazz.
One way or another, music has a way of reflecting the physical environment of its birthplace. Rhythmically complex musics tend to come from the tropics, where the air is loud with the babble of chattering birds and insects. In early jazz, music that came from places on the western plains, like Kansas City, was more rhythmically open than the relatively cramped, congested stuff coming out of New York. More recently, the ECM record label has popularized a brand of Scandinavian jazz that can be reserved to the point of iciness. As the cliche goes, it's like a bleak cry echoing down the fjords. That's music by the Finnish drummer and composer Edvard Vesala from his new album called Ode to the Death of Jazz. That horrid title refers to his low opinion of other people's music. It doesn't refer to his own stuff, which is still kicking. There's more to it than frozen saxophones. Vesala calls his orchestra Sound and Fury, and sometimes they come on like Vikings on the attack. I like this band's barbaric mode a lot. It's got almost punky energy. The key is Vesala's seemingly crude but effective drumming. He de-emphasizes his ride cymbals to get a dry, thumping sound. He's sort of a modern Gene Krupa. We'll be right back. As a band leader, Edvard Vesala is Finland's answer to American eccentric Sun Ra. Like Ra, he's sort of a crackpot outsider, working in seclusion, rehearsing his musicians in marathon sessions, and monopolizing their time. And like Ra, even when he plays something in a familiar vein, it comes out a little twisted. On Vesala's new album, he acknowledges a form of music that swept Europe early in the century and is still popular in Finland, the tango. That tango is Vesala's warmest piece. That makes sense, since the tango comes from the warmer environment of Argentina and Uruguay. You can understand why it has pleasant associations for Finns, whose country straddles the Arctic Circle. Come to think of it, environmental factors may explain why so many good big bands come from Scandinavia. In a frigid climate, musicians will huddle together to generate heat.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Edvard Vesala's new album, Ode to the Death of Jazz, on ECM. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, censorship and literature. A talk with Barney Rossett, the former owner of Grove Press. He published such controversial novels as Lady Chatterley's Lover, Naked Lunch, and Last Exit to Brooklyn. Also, we meet Grammy Award-winning singer and fiddler Alison Krauss. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.